Welcome to True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to a companion episode to the Showmax original Tracking Tabu Bester. In March, Showmax released another incredible original documentary, this time around the much-publicized and rather shocking Tabu Bester case. This companion podcast is best heard after you've watched the series. And if you've already watched it and you're a frequent listener of True Crime South Africa, you may have spotted a familiar face, or at least recognized my voice and put two and two together. In episode 3, I had the incredible pleasure of filming with Idea Candy and the Showmax team for a full day last year. It was a really cool experience. And I really do think that this documentary is an excellent deep dive into the case that's pretty much gripped South Africa for the last year. As I'm known to do, I found a few aspects of this case and the documentary that I wanted to explore more, and I figured there was no one better to help me do that than the two incredible young journalists who not only broke the story, but reported on it in a truly ethical way. Daniel Stain and Marisha Damons are journalists with Ground Up. In addition to the amazing investigative journalism work they did to bring the truth about this case to the public, they also wrote a book about the case called The Tabu Bester Story, and they played a major role in the Showmax documentary Tracking Tabu Bester 2. Before we go any further, though, if you have not been on social media at all, not read a single news article, watched television, or even chatted to Auntie Marty over the fence, and you have no idea who Tabu Bester is and what all this hullabaloo is about, let me give you a summary. In 2012, Tabu Bester was arrested, charged, and convicted with two counts of rape and one of the murder of Nomfundo Tihulu. He was sentenced to life and sent to Mangaung Correctional Facility in Bloemfontein to serve out his sentence. In May 2022, it was reported that Bester, who'd been given the moniker the Facebook Rapist, as he had used that social media site to lure many of his victims, had died after a fire had broken out in his cell. Publicly, that news barely made a blip on the radar. But by October 2022, journalist Marisha Damons was asking questions about Bester's death after several leads had come in to Ground Up. By January 2023, Marisha and Daniel had managed to gather enough evidence, including an autopsy report, to show that the person who had died in Tabu Bester's cell was very likely not him, and that the individual was in fact dead before the fire started. Bester was then also spotted shopping in a Woolworths store in Sandton with a woman whose name would become synonymous with his, Dr. Nandipa Magudumana. Eventually, the Departments of Correctional Services and the South African Police Service admitted that Tabu Bester had indeed not died in his prison cell, and instead, the staged scene had been the way he'd broken out of jail. And they didn't know where he was. As soon as Bester and Magudumana realized that they were being tracked, they fled the country. They were arrested and brought back to South Africa. They're now awaiting trial for the crimes they're alleged to have committed. It's emerged that Magudumana had been helping Bester to pull off a range of scams from his prison cell, ranging from fake property companies to appearing at scam celebrity-studded charity events by Zoom, also from his prison cell. That is the very short version. And I will admit that after covering 150 crime cases on True Crime South Africa, When the first whispers started that someone as unassuming as Bester had escaped from one of the country's most secure prisons, I scoffed. I won't deny it. I snorted and rolled my eyes and said there was no way anyone would get through all those layers of security. Sure, you can pay off a guard, but he's just one layer. Surely you couldn't pull that off, right? And I was wrong. He did. But as tracking Thabo Bester so perfectly showed, this shocking aspect of this case has become the least important part. And rather, what has emerged from this investigation is a few terrifying truths about systemic ineptitude and how valued and protected victims really are in this country. So let me introduce you to the two heroic journalists who showed the country not only what we didn't know, but also what we didn't really want to know, but desperately needed to.
My name is Daniel Stain. I'm a journalist at Ground Up News, as well as a freelance filmmaker.
My name is Marisha Damons, and I am a news reporter at Ground Up News. So Ground Up is a nonprofit organization, and we mainly focus on grassroots stories, things involving human rights issues, social justice. So that is also my main scope of journalism. But I generally focus on topics like the judiciary, education, housing, as well as human rights issues. And obviously now, with over the last year, my main focus has become Thabo Bester specifically. And more recently, I featured in the Showmax documentary Tracking Thabo Bester. So I do think that I can now include a contributor to my CV. So that is just a bit of what I do.
Marisha and Daniel have achieved as very young journalists what many never will in their entire careers. They've contributed to exposing and telling a story that will go down in South African history as groundbreaking and vitally important. In the last 18 months, they've taken on the Department of Correctional Services, the South African Police Services, helped track a rapist and killer on the run, testified in Parliament, written a book, and contributed to a four-part documentary. They are really only now sort of coming up for breath, when they aren't being interviewed by true crime podcasters, that is. They are representative of what I hope our entire future cast of South African investigative journalists will look like. Smart, ethical, energetic, seeking justice, and mostly unafraid. So, looking at them, I wondered how these two very different souls both came to be working at the same organization and ready to take on such huge systems as a team.
So I studied filmmaking straight after high school at AFDA. And then for my honors degree, I went to UCT and did a degree in film and media studies, but that included a semester course in journalism. And at the time I was interested in the intersection between film and journalism and to explore the documentary filmmaking space. That's taken me on several detours, from creating marketing videos for companies and NGOs to being a freelance journalist doing mostly written work. And yeah, so I've been full-time with Ground Up as a reporter since November 2022, but I maintain kind of an interest in filmmaking and documentary filmmaking. And I was fortunate to be involved with two documentary projects last year and this year, those being the Tracking Thabo Bester as well as the Illuminated.
So from a very, very young age, I've always had a passion for writing. I remember as a child, I had several diaries where I would just journal my thoughts. I'd also write my own little stories, and I enjoyed reading. And in primary school, I was part of our In Touch magazine, where we were about 10 learners, and we would compile this magazine that went out once a term. So that was sort of my first introduction to journalism in a sense, and that really excited me. I've also just always been such a people's person. I remember back in the day, my gran would call me a draadloos, which is the Afrikaans word for a radio, because I was always talking, I was always asking questions, and when people's answers were not good enough, I would ask them follow-up questions. So I think that moving into journalism was somewhat of an organic progression. And because of that, I decided to go and study journalism at Stellenbosch University. But because they only offered it as a postgraduate degree, I first did my undergrad in language and culture. And that aided me in doing other subjects like psychology, for example, which I think has become a very valuable asset in journalism in terms of understanding how people think and why people do what they do. And then after I had graduated, I then pursued my degree in journalism, which really, really helped me get a bigger understanding of the scope of journalism and just what it takes to go out, to cover stories, to pitch stories, to get your story ideas shot down, but to not give up because of that, but to keep pushing through, to understand how to work with people, what sorts of questions you need to ask, the stories that you need to focus on. So I do think that being a journalist has always sort of been in my blood. And that's why I feel very honored to have been able to achieve what I have already.
Yeah. So in the kind of after university, looking for job opportunities, GroundUp was one of the publications that attracted me, because it kind of has its root in human rights focused stories. It's got a very, I think, sober approach to reporting on issues that, you know, can be quite emotive and quite divisive. You know, we report a lot on issues like immigration, homelessness, recently the Gaza war, and so on. And I think our approach, even though ideologically we might be left-leaning, which informs what we report on, I think the way we report on it is very balanced and focuses on the facts more than opinion. We very rarely let our opinions dictate what we write. And that approach really attracted me to the organization when I was starting out as a freelancer, because I think the media has to play such an important role in South Africa, and it cannot risk being divisive and in the way that we see mainstream media in America and other places being. So I started as a freelancer, writing one or two stories a month while also working at a marketing company. And then I was very fortunate to be offered a full-time position in 2022.
I had just graduated and I was sort of interning at the SABC, where I worked as a radio journalist, and I was sort of figuring out whether that was the direction that I wanted to take in terms of journalism. And during my honors year, our editor at GroundUp, Nathan Geffen, had actually spoken briefly at one of our lectures about what GroundUp does, and we were able to ask him some questions. So that's how I became aware of who GroundUp is and what they do. So just coming out of varsity and sort of job hunting, I didn't expect, or rather, there wasn't this intention to specifically join GroundUp, but once the opportunity presented itself, I felt that I wanted to be a part of an organization that focuses on more impactful stories. And just the scope of work that GroundUp covers was not something that I was familiar with. So I thought that it would also be a bit of a challenge for me, and I like challenges. So that's why I was keen to join GroundUp.
As the pair discuss in Tracking Thabo Bester, this case, once it broke, essentially became their lives. They each had their own ways of dealing with the pressure, and I tried to put myself in their shoes for a moment. Marisha, for instance, is 25 years old. I can barely remember myself at 25, but I do know that I probably would not have been cut out to handle the public pressure of the work she had to do on this case. Now, they probably could have pulled out at any point, asked their editor to give the story to someone else, but neither did. And I wondered if at any point in this whirlwind, either of them had just sat back and gone, I actually do not want to do this anymore.
I think while we were reporting on the story, so like since I started joining the investigation at the start of 2023 to, you know, when they got arrested and went into court and everything, I think throughout that, I was totally confident in my role in the investigation and that we were doing something constructive and that this was what we were supposed to do. And the adrenaline rush throughout that, we really had fun in kind of a macabre way, I would say. And it really, yeah, it introduced me to a new aspect of journalism that I enjoyed. I think when it started to feel like old news, or when I started to feel burnt out, was kind of by the halfway of last year, and we'd been commissioned to write a book. Showmax was working on their documentary and contracted us to consult in that. And then there were moments where I felt, you know, that maybe it's time to move on. I'm very happy with, I think the book, both the book and the Tracking Tabu Bester documentary came out very well. I think it was well put together and sensibly done without, you know, it is a sensational story. And so it's inevitably sensational. But I think, you know, the story, the telling of the story needs to do justice to the victims of Tabu Bester. It needs to speak to the systemic issues that this story is a symptom of, and the structural issues in prisons. And I think, yeah, the documentary did that very well. But I think now I'm kind of getting to a point where, you know, if someone else comes along and says they're doing a documentary or a film, I might just politely decline because, yeah, it's time to move on. And I think we've made our contribution to the telling of the story.
I definitely think towards the end of everything, I started to feel a bit burnt out. And that's when I'd reached the point where I felt that I'm kind of done with the story. But when I started it, the idea was not that this man might have escaped. It was rather that government had failed to properly investigate a prisoner's death. So there was never even this intention or this thought process that maybe the story might blow up in any sort of way. So I do think that I came into it quite in a naive sense, but I would say that towards the end, when there was just so much workload and we were doing interviews and then there was the book and then there was family and friends being concerned about my safety, it was just so much going on. And I think that all of that led to me feeling incredibly burnt out by the story, so much so that I felt that I'm mentally and spiritually done with it.
Everything about this case is unbelievable. If you wrote a fiction book around the plot, people would tell you it belongs in the fantasy section. As I've already mentioned, I did not believe it for a minute when I first heard it. Put it down as a conspiracy theory. But I didn't have the evidence in front of me that Daniel and Marisha did. Despite that, at one stage, all they were working with were leads, tips emailed or called in to Ground Up, that they somehow had to verify. And I thought about what that moment was like for them, when they both had to accept that this was actually true. And they were smack bang in the middle of one of the craziest stories we've heard in a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, that was totally our reaction and my editor's reaction for quite a while. And the only real reason, okay, not the only real reason, but one of the real reasons we kept going with the investigation was because of the hard evidence that we were receiving from our then anonymous source, Justice Cameron, and other sources, you know, prison officials, prisoners reaching out and giving us evidence. And then, you know, evidence of the 21st century media company that he was running from behind bars, all of that reaching us. And so we had kind of that idea of assuming the most reasonable, simplest reason for this evidence and not trying to jump to conclusions. But it was the evidence that pointed us to the fact that there was this elaborate faked death scene and the involvement of a plastic surgeon, a celebrity doctor. We were skeptical from the start, and we maintained that skepticism. And that allowed us, that enabled us to approach whatever evidence we came across with level-headed and rationally. And I think throughout the investigation, we were reluctant to jump to conclusions. And that's why all our articles were very carefully worded, letting the reader decide for themselves what was happening here. I think even our 15 March article, which was the big expose of the evidence that we had gathered thus far of the escape, posed it as a question, simply saying, this is the evidence we have. We cannot definitively prove that Double Best is alive because we haven't seen him and we don't have photographic evidence of him alive. But this is the evidence we have, and this evidence clearly suggests that there's been this elaborate fake death scene. And then the next day, when I got the call to our office from someone who said, oh, they've got photos of Thabo Beston and Deepa Magudumana shopping together, and I saw those photos, then suddenly I had photographic evidence of him alive. And I think that was when the penny dropped and I realized that this bizarre conspiracy theory was actually true. And I think evidence-driven reporting and not theorizing, but just simply reporting the evidence we had is what drew people to GroundUp's reporting of the issue and maintained. I mean, our website traffic for that month is still the highest it's ever been. And we maintained quite a strong following of the story, because we were just focusing on the evidence. And I think that developed trust from people, whereas other media outlets reported some details which were proven to be completely wrong in the end.
If I think back to when my editor Nathan first gave me the story, he did make me aware of the fact that there were rumors that Bester had escaped. But just because these were rumors, I think that influenced my opinion of it being true. It did not seem possible that this man was able to escape from a maximum security prison. I mean, at the time when I started working on the story, it was my first time finding out about something like a private prison. I didn't even know that the country had any of those. So to me, I thought, okay, we've got a private prison in the mix and it's a maximum security prison. So the story doesn't make sense that Bester might have escaped. But I think the more that I started digging into it and finding out who he was and just what his crimes were and his modus operandi throughout everything, it sort of led me to maybe thinking that there is a possibility that if he had escaped, maybe this is what he would have done. But I think my moment of realizing that it was a possibility was after I'd spoken to a woman who used to work for 21st Century Media, which was one of the scam companies that Bester ran, because she had sent us an email back in like February of 2020, and we only came across it in 2023. And after speaking to her, she had just told me how he was able to pull off such an elaborate scam. And she believed that he had escaped and that the man who was found in the cell was not Bester. But I think just after speaking to her and getting a better sense of who Bester was, like outside of what was reported on, that led me to believe that there was actually this possibility that he actually might have escaped. Also, there were just so many unanswered questions, but I throughout everything had this nagging feeling that something is seriously amiss. And we've got this character who has this way of luring people and leading people and persuading them to believe what he is selling them. And it was just those antics that led me to believe that maybe this man actually did escape.
As much as the story exploded, the way in which Daniel and Marisha covered the story made it so that now it's really not so much about Besta and Magudumana anymore. They've sort of faded into the background. And what we've been left with are some serious issues. Daniel and Marisha have shown us that even when we think some of the most dangerous predators are locked away, maybe they aren't. They've shown us that the Department of Correctional Services is very keen on keeping their failures as deeply buried as possible. They've shown us that the SAPS doesn't seem to put much effort into tracking escaped criminals, even notorious ones, or, for that matter, warning the public that a dangerous rapist and murderer is on the loose. Most importantly of all, perhaps Daniel and Marisha have shown us that victims of violent crime in South Africa don't seem to be all that important to authorities. The woman raped by Besta, after all, and the family of the woman he murdered, had no idea that he was not dead. I asked Daniel and Marisha how they feel about these huge issues being brought forward.
It exposes the rot in so many South African government institutions. You know, just the timeline of the escape and what happened after that shows how the police just acted with tardiness and, I would say, incompetence, unable to do basic steps in the investigation. Partly because of lack of resources, partly because of lack of political will. The Department of Correctional Services not being able to investigate it properly, not being given sufficient evidence by G4S, which runs the prison. You know, JICS, the Judicial Inspectorate, trying to do their best to investigate, but also with very limited resources, also being withheld, evidence being withheld from them. And then G4S and Bloemfontein Correctional Contracts, which owns and runs the prison, taking no accountability, taking no responsibility for the investigation and simply leaving it over to an under-resourced, incapacitated and frankly useless police force to investigate a very intricate case. And that's why it took so long for them to take action. I mean, we know that by July 2022, 3 months after the escape happened, that the police had the autopsy report showing that the body was dead before the fire broke out. They had the DNA evidence or the mismatched DNA showing the mismatch between Macy Mabaso, Besta's biological mother, and the body found in the cell. They had the court papers from Nandipa Magudumana showing that she was actively involved in some capacity in the escape. And yet they did absolutely nothing with that information. And that's what prompted Justice Edwin Cameron to reach out to GroundUp with little breadcrumbs and little pieces of evidence to get us asking questions in the hope that it would light a fire under the authorities. And it took us a while, obviously, without the powers, investigative powers, without access to the prison, without the ability to subpoena people or certain pieces of evidence, it took us long to get to the point where we could report our evidence. And even then, so in March, which was 10 months after the fire, even then the Department of Correctional Services insisted that Dawie Besta was dead, that they hadn't been shown the autopsy report, which was completely false, that the investigation report was not complete, which was also false. There was a draft investigative report, which, to my knowledge, hasn't changed much between the draft and the final. That draft was completed in November 2022. So And then it was only about 10 days after our expose that the department admitted to the South African public that Thabo Bester had escaped. And only then did they activate a task force to track and trace him. Nandipha Magudumana and no other suspects had been brought into questioning. There was no surveillance of Nandipha Magudumana and her house where Thabo Bester was staying in Hyde Park. The police didn't seem to be aware of all the scam companies that Magudumana and Bester were running together. So all of that story shows you, you know, it's not just about a man escaping from prison and how easy it is to escape from prison. I think it's quite hard to escape from prison, and it takes someone with as much audacity and the resources that Thabo Bester had to get out of prison. But it's about our police force and our collective safety in that sense. It's about our correctional services and their ability to detain and to keep people behind bars, but also to do so in a way that is rehabilitative, that is keeps prisoners safe, that keeps the public safe. So it's all in all, it's quite a depressing picture of South Africa's state capacity, especially, I mean, the police, which is arguably the most important, especially with the scourge of crime stats that South Africa faces. The police is the most important institution in that sense.
I definitely think that the story has shone a light on the deeper rooted issues that our prisons and police systems actually have, because the story shouldn't have even blown up in the way that it did had the authorities actually done their jobs. I mean, from the beginning, we see that looking at how this individual died and what the official reason was for him dying, that was not adding up. And then we see that the DNA test showed that it wasn't Bester who had died in his cell. The story should have actually ended there. And this should have been a moment, I think, for the police to show the public that they can trust them, because look at this. We've been able to gather information that the person found in the cell was not Thabo Bester, and we've been able to catch him again. And I think that story would have maybe helped the nation to trust in police again. But unfortunately, that's not how things went down. It's exposed a deeper rot in our police system. And I think that that's incredibly unfortunate. And what I would say, though, is that the positive side in all of this, I guess, is that the Bester and Magudumana story is sort of taking a bit of a backseat, and things of prisoners' rights and paroles and parolees' rights has sort of taken the forefront. I also think issues regarding Home Affairs has come to the forefront, because how was it possible that someone existed in the country for more than 30 years, but they did not have an ID and they were in and out of prison? So that also calls into question how effective our prison systems actually are. And thankfully, these really crucial issues have been able to come to the fore in light of the story.
And while this case has definitely exposed these exact systemic failures and issues, I think it's also exposed something deeper about South Africa as a whole. And perhaps these issues are not just unique to South Africa, but that's where we live and where this case took place, so it's our focus. Bester managed to fleece a whole bunch of people, and I definitely don't believe that these people were any more or less gullible than the rest of us. Bester is incredibly manipulative and a really good scammer. But I don't think it was just that created the long string of people he scammed. Rather, perhaps it was our own propensity as a society to believe that all that glitters is gold, and monetary success, or at least what appears to be monetary success on the surface, somehow equates to goodness and strength of character. We want to believe, perhaps, that those who've become successful must have done so through hard work and honesty. And maybe we value the appearance of success so highly that we're willing to look the other way when things don't quite add up. Marisha had some thoughts around this too.
Absolutely. I think that the story as a whole speaks to the bigger issue of how society worships this image of excessive wealth. And I think Bester's story is not entirely unique. I mean, I would say that growing up, he would see that corruption pays, and it's not surprising that that's the route that he ended up taking in life. I think that it also showed this theme of just moral corrosion. Something that we like to quote is that biblical quote of the love of money is the root of all evil, and understanding that people will stop at nothing to acquire it, even if you need to cut corners and kill someone, scam some people out of their hard-earned money, just so that you can obtain that excessive amount of wealth. And I also think that it shows how if someone looks the part and they sound the part, that individuals like that must surely be trustworthy. Because if we look at someone like Dr. Nandipa, for example, I mean, this woman was somebody's wife. She was a mother, a doctor. She has this rags to riches story that I think a lot of South Africans can identify with. And just the life that she was living, looking at her lifestyle on all of the socials, that's something that a lot of people look up to and want to acquire. So I think that what the story has brought to light is that as a society, we really need to question why we value excessive wealth. And maybe it's time for us to start questioning whether the people who we sort of worship for having these large amounts of wealth are actually good people at the end of the day, and whether we should actually even be looking up to them.
One thing I've learned over the last few years as I've had opportunities to be involved in different film projects is that if you aren't in that industry, you have absolutely no idea how much goes into making the 4 one-hour episodes you watch on television. It is a huge undertaking. And now, when I watch documentaries, I see them with completely different eyes and really take in all the detail, because I know how much effort has gone into each and every scene. Daniel, as he mentioned, had studied film, so I wondered how the experience of filming with Showmax was for him.
Several people approached us in the past year about film projects and documentaries, and I think every production company under the sun suddenly said that they had an in with Showmax or Netflix or whatever. But when Idea Candy, which produced Tracking Double Bester, came along, you know, I'd recognized them from Devil's Door and Rosemary's Hit List and their other documentaries. So I knew that they were the real thing. And yeah, it took us some effort to convince our editor to go along with it, but in the end he did. And yeah, so it was great working with Idea Candy and Nikki, the director. We were consulting on that at the same time that we were kind of like in the last 2 or 3 months of finishing the book. So we were able to kind of cross-pollinate a lot. If Idea Candy came across something we didn't have, they would share that with us, and vice versa. So in a way, the documentary is, it's not an official adaptation of the book, but a lot of the information and content that's in the book has been translated into the documentary. Being involved in the documentary was great to see how it works from a research point of view, you know, the process of researching, how the outline that Nikki developed of what the documentary would look like at the start changed and had several iterations until the final product. And you know, some of it is, you know, the foundation stays the same, but a lot of the details get moved around. And I think that process of documentary filmmaking, more so than scripted filmmaking, where you've got a script and more or less what is in the final cut is what was on the script. You've got this collaborative process and ever-changing dynamic that changes depending on the interviews you do, depending on the shots you get, and depending on how the story unfolds. That's really quite an exciting process to have been a part of.
It was so interesting hearing Daniel describe documentary making that way. And it totally makes sense. I'm sure that many of the Showmax original documentaries are like this when they're being made. You're telling the stories of real people. And even when cases are solved and complete, the story you think you're going to tell is not always the exact same story you end up telling.
Yeah, it makes it so exciting. And it makes it collaborative because it all depends also on your editor and how the editor sees the content that you filmed and puts it together. And you see everything in new ways that you hadn't seen it before.
Despite this organic nature of documentaries, they're still limited by time, which is why we have companion podcasts like this. So I wondered from Marisha and Daniel's perspective whether there was anything they would have liked to have been included in the documentary that either couldn't fit in, or if there were any elements they would have liked to have delved deeper into.
I don't think so, but what I would say, though, is that the only concerning thing throughout this whole story and expose, and even with the documentary and all of the interviews and everything that has gone out, was how there are still some people who are seeing Bester as some sort of a hero because he was able to slip through the cracks and dodge police for so long and scam people in this very extravagant manner. And a lot of people, for some reason, see that as something worthwhile of praising Bester for. I think especially if we see the types of people who he was able to scam. I mean, it was people who are in the top percentage of society and individuals, like especially where people are praising Bester and they're hailing him as some sort of a hero because of what he was able to achieve and how many people he was able to scam and things like that. I find incredibly disappointing because even though on the one end, people have seen that the story is incredibly disturbing and that we need to be more vigilant to scam artists, there's this group of people who are seeing Bester as some sort of a hero because of his ability to dodge police and get away with so much and fake his own death. Because even though I understand that the story is incredibly sensational, and if you were to tell it to someone in a different country who's never heard of it, they wouldn't believe that it is a real story. We do still need to remember that they are real victims with real trauma that they are still dealing with. And seeing that Bester has, in a sense, been resurrected, they now also have to go through their trauma again, which is now being reignited with Bester, who has, I guess, risen from the dead. So it, in a sense, has just been disappointing to see that there is this group of individuals who don't see anything wrong with what Bester has done.
I think the documentary was very comprehensive. It covered, thematically, it covered every area, really. I think one aspect that wasn't included was Nandipa's bizarre court case. You know, they make mention of it in the documentary, but it's not elaborated on, is where Nandipa, after returning to South Africa, wanted the court to declare her arrest unlawful. And it became quite a fascinating legal debate over whether her extradition, so her and Thabo Bester were arrested in Tanzania by Tanzanian authorities. The South African government then sent a delegation to Tanzania to bring them back. Because Bester was a convicted felon, he could just be deported back and be put straight into prison. But Nandipa was arrested there on immigration, you know, contravening their Immigration Act. And, you know, according to international law, if you're being extradited to a country to face charges in another country, you need to go through an extradition process. But in this case, there was no extradition process because the idea was that because she had broken a law there, the government of Tanzania could just deport her. So, you know, a quick agreement was made with the Tanzanian government to bring Nondipa and Thabo back to South Africa. They both got onto the plane, which happened to be a private jet that cost 1.2 million rand. And they landed in South Africa and she went straight into a prison cell. And she then went to the court and said, wait a minute, I was extradited without due process. And her lawyers in court very eloquently explained that there's no such thing as a deportation back to a country. You can be deported from the country, but the country that you're in cannot determine which country you go to. You know, she could have then gone to any country that she wanted to or that would have had her. So the fact that she was picked up by South African officials in Tanzania and brought back to South Africa, she argued that meant that she was extradited without process, and therefore her arrest was unlawful, and that the charges she was facing in South Africa should be declared null and void. You know, so what she was asking for might have was probably going a bit too far, but the legal argument was quite compelling. And in fact, the court found that, and this was the Free State High Court in Bloemfontein, the court found that she had actually indeed been extradited without due process, and that it was an unlawful extradition. But crucially, the court said that because she agreed to get on the plane, and when the time came to get on the plane, she did not argue. She told everyone that she was going home to see her children and she wanted to go home. She got onto the plane willingly without putting up a fight. Because she did that, she was consenting to it. And that means that there's nothing the court can do to declare her charges null and void or to declare that the South African court system doesn't have current jurisdiction to charge her and put her on trial. And that was quite a close call. You know, if she had put on a fight in Tanzania and been put on the plane against her will, it could have had a different outcome. And so she's appealed that ruling, saying, well, you can't consent to an unlawful action. And the Supreme Court of Appeal has accepted her petition, but it's yet to be decided or to be confirmed when that will be heard in court again. And in the meantime, the criminal trial is still ongoing. So I'm not sure which will happen first, the Supreme Court of Appeal hearing or the end of the criminal trial.
Marisha Damon's and Daniel Steyn's lives have changed pretty significantly in a very short space of time. They went from hard-working social justice journalists, writing for Ground Up and doing great work, of course, to exposing one of the most important stories, possibly of the decade. Not because of Besta's infamy, but because of what it means for the South African public, and publishing a book, and contributing to an incredibly popular Showmax original documentary series. I asked them how different their lives are now from 18 months ago.
It's definitely an odd experience now that more people know who I am. I mean, a couple of years back, if I Googled my name, they would show, did you mean Matt Damon? So at least now, Google is not giving people a did you mean result. So it's been a very interesting change for me. Firstly, just people recognizing me, more people knowing me. But I think also it's been a very important leap in terms of the work that we do at Ground Up, because now we don't have to over-explain who Ground Up is and what we do whenever we go out and cover stories, because people are familiar with the Thabo Besta story and that Ground Up were the ones who broke the story. But it's been such a surreal experience for me, and I am obviously very just humble about everything that I have been able to achieve so much at such a young age. I think something else that I have also noticed is that a lot more people are sending me requests with their own stories, whether it's them being scammed or whether it's something to do with a dodgy story within their organization or their company, or even if it is related to the government. So with what the story has done is it has thrust us into the public eye. And I think there's now this element of trust, just given how we dealt with the story. And now more people are a lot more comfortable with coming to Ground Up to cover their stories.
Funnily enough, you know, I hadn't been active in the film industry at all, but an old film school friend of mine, Vainant Lowe, had seen that I was involved in a video about Tabu Bester, and had seen that video, and then put two and two together that, you know, I'm now in journalism, and he was working on The Illuminated, which he's the creative producer and director behind, and then reached out to me and asked me to be a part of that. So this whole story has opened so many opportunities for me.
I really do think Showmax has hit the nail on the head again with tracking Tabu Bester. It was always going to be a difficult case to encapsulate into four episodes, and I think they've managed to select exactly the most important points to focus on. What's important now is what we do with the information we've been given. How do we, as citizens of South Africa, who ultimately suffer at the hands of the structures who've been shown to be so wanting, hold these structures and the people behind them accountable? Tabu Bester and Nandipha Magudumana will undoubtedly remain a jaw-dropping true crime story, but we can only hope that the law will now deal with them and justice will take its course. And maybe we really do have to hope that, because, well, that's what we thought the last time this man stood before a judge too. If you haven't yet watched the Tracking Tabu Bester series on Showmax, I highly recommend it. And if you have watched it, I highly recommend watching it again or inviting over a friend who hasn't watched it. Thank you so much to Daniel Steyn and Marisha Damons for their incredible work as journalists and for agreeing to be interviewed for this episode.